is Edwin K. Morris, and you are about to embark on the next Pioneer Knowledge Services Because You Need to Know, a digital resource for you to listen to folks share their experience and knowledge around the field of knowledge management and nonprofit work. Make sure you check out Pioneer Knowledge Services website and find all the information about the Midwest Knowledge Management Symposium happening in June. You should be there. I'm with Paul Corney. Paul is gracious enough to meet me at the hotel I'm at for the European Conference on Knowledge Management here in Lisbon, Portugal. Why is it I see Lisbon and then Lisboa?
Because one's Portuguese, one's English.
Okay. Tell me about this project you're working on and why you started it.
You know, when you've worked as many years in as many industries and as many countries, you sort of look back. My mother is 95, and about 5 years ago, I invited all of our relatives to her 90th birthday party, which was a surprise for her. And I said to her, "You're attending your wake." I said, "How often do you go? You go to a wake or a sort of a memorial or whatever, and all you ever get in that situation is people saying nice things about you, or just everyone turns up and you're not there." And I said, "Isn't it better to be there?" And she's 95 and a half and still going strong. And so that was, in a way, it was that sort of, I've worked in so many places with so many people, and I've been privileged. I've learned CERN so much. I thought, why don't I invite people to share their experiences, good and bad, but by way of stories or anecdotes, with a view to maybe then being able to pick on that and look at some of them. What are the themes? What is it that I've said and done that's actually made a difference either to people's lives or to their businesses? Mm. And then start to share those again in the future. Mm-hmm. That was sort of, it was a few months ago, I think.
So wait a minute. So you went through your Rolodex of all these contacts and you're like, oh, that's a good one. So you made a list of folks that you want, or did you just shoot it out to everybody?
It was a little bit. Well, first of all, I wrote a blog on my site, Knowledge et al. I wrote a blog. I actually put a new page up called a collaborative valedictory. Well, most people don't know what the hell a valedictory is, but a valedictory is what typically ambassadors used to write back at the end of their tour of duty. Ah. And it was funny, and I talk about it in a response to someone. I was at the Middle East Association one day with Sir James Craig, who was the former ambassador, British ambassador to Saudi Arabia. There was a discussion going on. His valedictory message had somehow been released to a newspaper called The Scotsman. And The Scotsman had written it all, and it was a very delicate time in Anglo-Saudi relations. Mm. A lot of what he said was very good and very true and very, very articulate. But it was very awkward, obviously. And he got this phone call from the then Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Margaret Thatcher, said, "Come over, we have an issue to deal with." And that was when people started thinking about the valedictory. Hmm. It's a way of looking back and reflecting on things.
So it's an introspection, a deep dive in what you really gathered from the experience.
Exactly, from observing and being in different countries. It was always a very, very secret document. And I thought, well, rather than me doing that, why don't I invite people I've worked with? The body of knowledge is not just mine, it's everybody's.
Well, it's definitely a perspective.
Yeah.
You've engineered what they refer to as a 360 perspective
yeah.
of your impact.
Correct.
Or your effect on the world.
Exactly. And I didn't know I was going to fall flat on my face. I didn't start off thinking I'd get 50.
Yeah.
But you suddenly realize you've got loads of connections, and a lot of these people aren't even on LinkedIn. They don't need to be.
Oh, yeah, right.
And some of them, I can't say what their role is now, But what surprised me, in fact, a very good friend of mine who actually we normally meet in Lisbon, a guy called Luis Suarez, he and I were talking about this and he said, why didn't you do it? And he wrote the first one. Hmm. And it really got me thinking because he talked about the ability to tell stories. And one of his comments was, there's always a story. What I've done it with everyone, and as I said, I've built it up. It was about in June, I came up with the idea.
Oh, this year?
Yeah. And I just posted something on LinkedIn. I posted the blog and I talked about my early years and how I came into being where I was today. And then I invited people. I said, if you've got something you want to contribute.
So is that all the primer you gave these folks?
Yes. And then I sent, once you get the ball rolling, you then say, look, I'm doing this. If you've got something you'd like to contribute, I'd be honored. And that was it. And nothing else.
Whatever they bring.
Or don't. I can only think of two people who have not. And they came back with, look, I can't better what's written. I felt really honoured because there's a friend of mine, for example, who I was his first boss back in about 1983, 84. He got an OBE in the end for his services to Islamic banking. He ended up being chairman of a big...
OBE standing for...
Order of the British Empire. Some of the things he talked about stuck with him, you know, throughout his whole career. I was particularly honoured when a former cabinet minister and now a lord went back and reflected on the times that we'd all spent and some of the things I did.
Out of that process, did things pop up that you were like, wow, I didn't remember that? Or do you know what I mean? Were there things that people had perspectives of that said, remember that time? And you're like...
There was. Yes, there was. And this is sort of what, as an illustration, when the Gulf War was on, back in...
Which one?
what was it? I shall never forget. You'll remember better than me, the George Bush statement. The George W. Our bank was obviously was a very big player because Saudi Arabia was obviously the launch pad for so many of the sorties and things. And actually, I got a phone call on the 1st of January from my friend who was the treasurer of the oil company at the time saying, we need your help. We've got to buy $200 million worth of floating storage because the Abrahams tank runs on jet fuel. There was a great deal of concern about whether the refineries, if they got hit...
Where were they going to do?
So we went through all that. Well, anyway, my colleague and I... guy called Bill Allen. He talks about our experience because we were doing an assignment to help one of the refineries with its cash management, a joint venture refinery with Shell in the Eastern Province. He remembers us. I remember doing it, but he remembered in much greater detail. We actually had to, we couldn't fly to Saudi Arabia. We had to fly to Bahrain and drive across the causeway. And then we ended up spending... We were sharing hotel rooms with desert rats and things. And we were there when the tanks were coming back in bits and the oil fires were burning. And he remembered some of those. And it was always, as he said, it was always that thing about the tact and diplomacy and doing what you're going to say you're going to do that differentiates you from other people. To answer your question, there have been things that are hidden down here that get brought back to the surface and are triggers. They're triggers for stories.
So what good has this brought you?
Good. Not satisfaction is the wrong word. I think it's more feeling of achievement. I've impacted so many people in so many different ways, and that sounds arrogant. It's not meant to be. You can read the 50. They're all available online. It's not coming to closure as much. A person who wrote the 50th talked about it being a chance to not clear the decks, but to consolidate, curate everything, and then move on to whatever the next chapter
is. Next, yeah.
But most of us never have that opportunity, do we? Sure. And we never actually know what's happened. And one of the guys who actually attended my wedding in the end, funny, he was the chief information officer for a reinsurance group in the city, and I was working with the CEO and the chairman. He remembers that he was having a particularly difficult time at the time because he was in charge of technology and he wanted a big budget to get all this through. Mm. He actually says in his reflection that I said to him, what the hell are you moaning about? You get paid a fabulous salary and you do what you want to. And he said no one had ever sort of talked to him like that. And it was the best possible advice he could ever get.
So you set him at ease, or you brought in a level of hate?
And there are little things that you do like that, Edwin, that make such a difference. Because people don't do that. This cold idea, I was consulting with them, and in fact I ended up working with them off and on for about 7-8 years, as I used to go in once a month. And I would have like a surgery, and people would come and see me and discuss their issues. And we introduced a precursor to knowledge management effectively in the organisation. So there is that feeling of, not closure, there's that feeling of, there are things that I've always believed in that I've put in place with different businesses. They range from the largest public company in Iran to software business that I was proud to be the business and strategy advisor for 5-6 years during the dot-com crisis, and I had to integrate all the acquisitions. So I learned a lot about how do you bring Dutch, English, German and Americans together. You know, some of the guys talk about that. The CEO at the time talks very fondly about that, as does the chief technology officer, who is still there 20 years on, and the company's still going. And they still do those things. What would Paul Corney have done in that situation? Mm. Which is, to me, is massively encouraging.
So how does an organization that values, and I'm going to say it's people, because this is a people thing, stories are for people, what's the benefit, and how does an organization do something like this?
Well, it's funny. Many years ago, and actually it comes back to where we are, a friend of ours who was a guy called Alec Taylor invited us, my wife and I, to go and be part of a weekend where we helped a very old business in a place called Monsaraz, which is to the east of Lisboa. It's on the way to Évora. And she had an old hand looming weaving business. And the covers and the mats were worn. In fact, Prince Charles's polo pony used to have one of their cloaks. And they were called manta alla tigiana, which are the cloaks shepherds and others used to wear. People doing really high upmarket hotels would have these on the wall. And she was trying to think about where her business should go, and Alec invited us. We met lots of people that we're still very friendly with. Well, Alec was, a former presenter on an Irish television show, completely bizarre. Anyway, Alec ended up doing something he called Memoirs on Camera, where he'd go to people as a gift. The organisation would go back and he'd have these interviews like that.
Interesting.
Now, I've done the same thing in organisations where we've talked a lot. In fact, I ran masterclasses here on, you know, exploiting tacit knowledge in organisations. How do you capture? And myself and a lady called Victoria Ward, who I was working with, we did a big piece of work for the UK's Revenue and Customs, HMRC, on how do you transfer critical knowledge? What is critical knowledge? How do you transfer it? So this is another technique of surfacing the stories. And then I go back and say, okay, and my takeaway from this is...
The idea of asking in a very general scope or sentence, hey, would you be willing to give your input on what you think? I don't even know, how did you say it?
Well, let me go back. I mean, this is one of these things, this looks really good on radio. I actually tell a story, and these reflections basically ask people two questions. Can you think of an incident, event, or project, piece of work we were both involved in that sticks in your mind? And if you were to sum up in a word, phrase, anecdote, or piece of advice what you took away from working together, what would that be?
So neither one of those questions do you say me.
Yeah, yeah.
You're just saying in general. So you're not even asking about it with you as the centerpiece.
No, because it's as much them as it is me. It's not about what did I do. And that whole thing, Edwin, about co-collaboration, co-create. I said these reflections don't have to be earth-shattering, big or even international. They might be amusing as well as insightful.
Exactly.
What I did then was I said, here's an anecdote from me. Like all good stories, they have to have a title, and it was called Dress to Impress, okay? I remember one occasion in Riyadh when, as a fledgling young banker, I was about to have dinner at an ambassador's residence. My then boss, Ford Fraker, later to become US ambassador to Saudi Arabia, who was accompanying me to the dinner, suggested as a mark of respect that I buttoned up my jacket before being presented to the ambassador. It was my first experience of a formal dinner, and the way Ford shared the experience stayed with me. He explained the importance of personal presentation in getting attention. And some decades later, while giving a keynote in Colombia, I deliberately changed my appearance and dressed down in slacks and a jumper to stand out from the suited crowd. Mm-hmm. So that was it. I'm not saying do it like this.
Yeah.
It was a way of illustrating what you can...
What was remarkable, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that someone gave you, I assume, unsolicited advice.
Yeah.
I didn't say, button that up, you know.
Yeah.
But it made a difference. Apparently it made a difference in your mind.
Of course. And very often, people who are good at this will say, I hope you don't mind me mentioning this.
Yeah.
My wife is the best negotiator I've ever met. Right? And she sells high-value homes.
Okay.
It's a technique she will do. If there's an empathy thing, a touching thing, look, I hope you don't mind me saying, it lowers the tension.
Yeah. Does that get a different result than saying, are you open to feedback? Do you think there's a different play on it? Does it really open up an empathetic channel better?
If you smile, because if are you open for feedback, almost feels like, doesn't
it? Oh boy,
yeah. What's he going to say?
Exactly.
What's she going to say?
Yeah.
Whereas there is that thing, and the word that comes up a lot, and I'll do a wordle, I'll do a word cloud at some point with this. The word that comes up a lot is empathy.
Huh?
Yeah, it's showing empathy with people. And in a way, that's sort of the same issue.
That goes to the nature of you, then.
It does,
not so much anything other than that.
No, but it also comes from, I think, the confidence of being in situations, you know, being at the end of a gun in loads of places and being told you're going to be marched off to wherever, you know. And I remember being on a UN mission. We were working, doing a... looking at knowledge management in a humanitarian crisis in Darfur with the WHO many years ago, back in 2010. It was, I mean, look at Sudan today. A lot of my friends are still there, and it's a place I love with people. I love it. It's devastating. But at the time, every night, we had to ring in for security at 8 o'clock, and we went through advanced UN security training. If I'm in a place like that, I'm always going to be not above floor 7 and not below floor 3, and certainly not at the front of the building. And those things stay with you, and you learn to... You take those experiences as you go along, and it's the ability to share those sometimes that... As Luis said, it's the stories that bring stuff to life.
The only negative I can think with the paradigm of it's the story is that you have to have an audience that wants to hear a story.
Of course. And you can dress it up in a different way. That's why I've always believed in, like, the power of PowerPoint slides, even if it's just a picture. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise I'll ramble off into the wilderness. One of the things, I was giving someone some tips the other day. Let me tell you something. This is a true story.
Okay.
Many years ago, a friend of mine was about to go and give a speech. It was with the bank, and he was giving a speech to a very distinguished gathering in Japan. He said, did I even have any tips? And I said, yeah, well, there's one thing I've learned over the years. And I watched somebody die in Russia, literally, or at Moscow, trying to do it. I said, don't tell a joke. And he said, oh, okay, fine. Anyway, he came back, and I'd got the transcript of the thing. He came back and he said, oh, this was brilliant. He said, you were wrong, though. And I said, in what way? He said, well, I did tell a joke, and everyone laughed. And then I told another one, and people laughed more. And I didn't have the heart to say, because the transcript said, laugh, the Englishman's telling a joke. And then laugh louder, the Englishman's telling another joke.
So it's not appreciative of the joke, it's just...
Yeah, and it's the rituals that you go through.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the dangers. You have to understand, you can't just rock up. You have to understand the environment, the culture, the people.
Well, right, yeah.
And sorry, I'm just going to say another example. I used to chair KM Hong Kong sometimes, or KM Asia. I learned very quickly one of the worst things you could do was ask for comments from the audience. Because people don't. They don't
they
put
don't
themselves
interact
forward.
That way?
No, it's not the way they interact. So one of the things that we used to do was we'd get people standing up. I'd go around with a microphone, and I'd say, what did you think about that?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd ask them to choose the next person. So it became a bit of a game. And it lowers the tension again.
It gets rid of that hierarchy.
Exactly. And then it becomes more of a conversation rather than somebody talking down or saying, I want to extract something from you.
So the sensitivity to the audience, I'll say, comes with age and experience. And not to be cautionary in all things, you have to be true to yourself at some point. But given the idea of the sensitivity, I was presenting at a university in Ohio, and I had a very diverse group of folks, probably 30 or 40 people in the room. My great idea was to do, I'm going to make the human abacus. So I would say, okay, so this side of the room is 0, and this side of the room is 10, and I want you all to filter yourself out in between or all the way to the ends, and I would ask a question. How many rooms in your apartment, or just nonsensical things that would show commonality of people and be a bridge to, give a different observation. One of the questions was, how many brothers and sisters do you have? It wasn't until much later, someone of a Asian background came up to me and said, you know, you had some Chinese people in there. Okay. Well, they don't have more than one. So it may have made them feel a little uncomfortable. I was like, I wasn't aware of that.
No.
It was not even part of my paradigm. No. There is a sensitivity that needs to be administered.
When you work in so many different countries, one of the things you realize, it's very easy from a customs perspective to fall foul without realizing.
Yeah.
We were in Iran about 10 years ago, and we were about to lead an event. Mm. Somebody insisted the table where we were sitting on this raised dais. Somebody insisted on us having coffee. There was a book, and I was just about to put it down, and of course it was on the Quran. It was so fortunate I didn't, but it could easily have gone the other way, and the audience almost would have gasped. The other thing is, you would never, certainly in Muslim countries in East Asia, you would never extend your hand, you put your hand on your chest to start with, to see if people do want to. It's that way we go in. You need to go in with your antenna, and you need to watch. One of the things we were talking earlier on about, as you get older, you get wiser and get more confident, hopefully. One of the big issues for me, Edwin, was...
That does not naturally occur.
No, it does doesn't, not. You're right. As you start forgetting things, don't you? And there is nothing worse when you're giving the keynote. And you... Now, where was I? And we've had seen these things. So now, I've actually got to the point where I'll say to somebody, now, what was I saying? Now, guess what?
Yeah.
Everybody's there. Everybody pays attention after that point. And I do that deliberately
sure.
now. It's a way of engaging. And if you ramble without purpose. I was very lucky in my early days at the bank. We got trained on presentations by, he was equerry to the, I don't know, it was the Queen or somebody. But he had a very good presentation background and was incredibly competent. And there were a couple of things. One was the did you get that pause? I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Tell me.
You look up the audience and you just wait. If you're not talking in the first language, it's very important that people have time to synthesize what you've said.
Yeah.
Instead of going, blah, 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 or the worst one is you can read the slide yourself. Well, why are you here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why didn't you send the PowerPoints out in advance? So one of the things with the did you get that pause, and that was significant always for me. And the other thing was this, the buttoning of the jacket when you go on the stage, or they were just little things.
Yeah.
One of the things he said, which I know politicians do, he said, tell them what you're going to say, tell it to them and tell them what they've said. And that makes it much easier to do.
Yeah.
When we talk knowledge management, it's all about stakeholder management, and that's all about how you communicate.
Where's the place of the story fit in? Again, the centerpiece of what your effort has been, and you're labeling it the 50...
I call the collaborative valedictory.
The collaborative valedictory.
Yeah.
If an organization wants to build more of introspection, and that's what I hear that this sounds like, this is a not professional development, but it may be, but it's definitely personal development for those that are willing to hear
Correct.
Some of the content coming their way.
And I think there are It's a variation, isn't it, on an after-action review. Okay. If you think about it, I changed that once to, and I used the phrase pause and reflect because I thought, to be honest, it's less military.
Yeah.
And people often felt much more comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I was one of the founding trustees of a charity, which is going really well still for the making use of surplus food. They talk about the experience of the difference I made there. And I was actually called a knowledge trustee. When you have so many volunteers and you're running events, it's how do you transfer the learnings from one event to the next event? We would spend quite a lot of time on that. So, for example, things like when we were talking about making use of surplus food, we would have big collection days where people would give dry goods and surplus foods and from the market. So Borough Market, which is one of the biggest markets in London, on a Saturday evening, all of it gets redistributed, goes off to charities and others to be used. We set up the whole purpose of having pause and reflects.
Well, similar in the framework of an after-action review, you waited until a project or a certain action was done?
The addition, which you don't tend to get in an after-action review, is what behaviours did you find that were really helpful?
Ah, that's a better way to phrase it.
Yeah. Because people don't talk about that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I just had a conversation that said that in their lessons learned paradigm, the question is in this way asked, did you learn anything? And it's very stodgy. That seems very stodgy to me. That does not invite stories at all.
No.
So now I have to value what I tell you to say, is this new? Maybe.
Okay, so I'll tell you a true story from Darfur. We were interviewing people who'd been on the front line, health workers, medical workers, all sorts of people from NGOs and others. Mm-hmm. There was a lovely young German doctor from Bavaria. She'd spent most of her working life there. And they'd built this field hospital and the rebels destroyed it. And it's very difficult to be in that situation because you're almost holding back the tears, both of you. But what I found was a really good way was having a blank sheet of paper with a timeline and you fill in highlights and lowlights, so above the line and below the line, and it was a technique that we used with Save the Children when they were having their annual meeting in Bangladesh, where we invited all the 29 regions to actually do like a picture with pictures of highlights above the line and lowlights below the line, just three things in the year, and then you put it up around the wall.
For the sake of understanding, when you say above the line and below the line,
well, above the line is, so you start on the left-hand side with the beginning of the year, the end of the year. Above the line are things that were positive, and below the line, things that were negative. Yeah. And that idea of a timeline, it's like having a, I wrote about this many years ago about buying a mobile phone, where you went to somebody who sits behind the desk and does this, just types, with you as a barrier, and someone else who fills in like a worksheet for you, which you co-create, and that way they give it back to you. It's your record of what you're looking for. So guess who's you're going to buy the phone from?
Yeah.
It's a neutral piece of paper. In my days as a banker, one of the techniques that I used to use a lot when I was trying to understand the organisation, I'd go in and I'd write down who did what and what they did, and people love to correct you.
Well, you got engagement. Well, there's an idea you presented is that once you transfer what you're thinking to an image, that makes a whole different impression and a way to perceive.
Of course. We used to ask when I was with Spark Now many years ago, I was a managing partner of Spark Now, and we used to go out into the field to interview people. In one situation, we were doing an oral history project. Another one with the Asian Development Bank, we were capturing the sights and sounds of what it felt like to work there.
Interesting.
Yeah, and you can find it still there. And we actually did a CD with a guy called David Gunn, who was a great sound engineer. And we had interviews. And in fact, Carol Russell, Shakespearean actress, talks about the experience because she's 5'4". She's from Jamaica. and she can ululate, so she can really hold a room. And she's an author. She used to write for EastEnders. And so she was part of the team, and she and I used to go out in the Philippines. It was funny. So we'd go around, and we were like the odd couple, because we stood out, you know. Can imagine creating these interviews. What we used to do was we'd ask people to bring along an object or an artifact or an image of something, and then they would talk about it.
So we're going back to grade school.
Oh, totally.
Show and tell. You know, bring something that means something to you and tell something about it. So where does that fit into the modern and new culture coming about with digitization? How do we bring that and make it more interactive, more easy to build things and co-create things?
It doesn't actually change, does it?
I think the process and the human interaction is definitely the same. All the tools are different.
Yeah, the tools are different. You've got the ability to show images.
Yeah.
And to be honest, sometimes you can show more images. What you don't want to do is have too much detail. That's the danger, because we get lost in the detail
and then everybody draws back and stop.
Yeah. I was always skeptical when I first started with this whole idea about corporate stories. And corporate stories for me have always been dangerous, because they're far too prescribed. It's got to be events, anecdotes, that you can draw back on.
Well, you're targeting, again, tacit knowledge. Yeah. I like to use the word elucidation, which means to put light to or bring out and show. Mm. Most tacit knowledge takes, in my view, a little propagation and somebody that can ask digging questions in order to get that brain to start, that's a good question. Let me think. And then I think that really is the spark and igniter to digging into tacit knowledge, because there's a level of unawareness in the person to begin with.
It's very true. Last night, for example, we were having dinner with some family friends in Qashqai. It was really interesting because one of the attendees, one of our best friends, she's a professor of, goodness knows what the title is in Portuguese. it's basically in the treatment of autism. It's autism. Oh. Autismo here. She's written two books on the subject, and she has a methodology called PIPA, which is very effective. And one of the pieces of work that she and I did with her a few years ago was helping her to think the idea of deep smarts, Dorothy Lenner's deep smarts. Yep. It's how you create a cadre of people who are sufficiently skilled in the methodology and to take that forward such that other people might learn. And in a way, you asked a question about this whole thing. This is sort of the same thing, because if I can share some of the experiences and people can say, this is what it meant for me, or this is how it changed me, others may say, yeah, hey, or they may just say, it's psychobabble, I don't know. But then those sort of people probably deserve to be in a dark room with the screen on all the time anyway.
The self-awareness is definitely a variable in a lot of different people. That seems to be the wick, if you will. If it's a short wick, then it's faster to action.
Yeah.
If it's a long wick,
So I guess sort of bringing it to a bit of a close rather than keeping people on this for hours. I guess one of the questions that you would ask me, I guess, is, well, what next? And one of the things that for me that's really important is other people can say to me, well, okay, we think you can do this with it. Yeah. And I've already had suggestions of an ebook, which is, and I'm talking to somebody, a good friend of mine, John Girard, who you've heard of, did a very good ebook. Which I contributed to, called Knowledge Management. I can't remember what it was. Knowledge Management, KM Matters, 13 or so of us who were asked to contribute. And I wrote a chapter on, I think it was when they leave, their knowledge and their networks leave with them. Because that's the thing people forget. So that's one aspect. Another is whether I use technology and give it to it and say, okay, come up with the themes. I tried that with the first few, and it was very powerful. But this is a massive body of work.
Yeah.
And I'd be interested in your ideas here. The other thought is whether this is something, because I lecture at some of the business schools and universities, whether you give this to the students and you say, okay, as part of your thesis or whatever? Or what lessons would you
take
draw
this
out?
Content, synthesize it, and make it usable for certain demographic?
Yeah. So I don't know. The jury's out.
I like the sounds of that because it's a project based. And by doing the project, they're going to absorb... That's
partly my thing. Yeah. So I've got to decide which are the right universities.
Now, the last thing that you did not mention is that use a digital twin. So you can actually turn something static, like text, boom, into something that's watchable, seeable.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Cool. Yeah. So that leads me to the last question is, what questions do you have of me?
So where do you take what you're doing?
Where do I take it? Well, as
you know...
Because
you've come from... I think I was your first, wasn't I?
I don't think you were the first. You may have been the first KM Lobby.
Yes.
That was a certain type of podcast that we created.
Yeah.
So the KM Lobby was a three perspective KMers from around the globe with one person in the hot seat as a guest.
Yeah.
So Pioneer Knowledge Services is the first, and as far as I know, only charity in the United States that is built for knowledge management. We are a knowledge management charity. Our mission is to help other nonprofits and to educate. The podcast was just a way that I could start stories, start pulling tacit knowledge as a shareable, reusable source that's publicly available. That has grown. It has, as you see, it has picked up speed and momentum. Are we cashing in yet? No, not yet. So we're getting there. The idea is that we'll get some sponsorship to support all that. But the intent is why I'm here now. I had a paper that was suggested by the European Space Agency early this year to talk about how I'm using podcast and elucidation, not just question and answer kind of fluffy stuff, but really dig. So we built a bit of a process, built a paper that has been accepted, and it's a work in progress classification as far as academics go. It sets the stage and says, look, we now have this schema with this intent. What we want to do is now come back next year and tell you what we found out and the actual value of transfer based on this elucidation process via podcast intra-organizationally. So within the organization, it is really to build contextual knowledge, contextual relationship building amongst the people in the organization. Will it supplement knowledge management, best practices, any other things that are going on in the organization? No, it will be a standalone. It'll just be another way, period. So that's our intent right now.
Well, that's exciting in itself.
It is very exciting. I love this stuff. I really do.
I can see in, I don't know how many businesses are mentioned, but I can see even going back when I helped a fledgling young couple with a restaurant business. I went there one day, lived in a very old town called Lewis. So Lewis was a Twitter town. It was before X. It was a Twitter town. We used to have Tweeter where everybody who was on Twitter would meet once a month in a pub. Fantastic. I mean, what a great idea.
That's a community builder.
Yeah, it was a community builder. Yeah. And it's a university town without a university. It's where, seriously, it's got more high court judges and everything. It's very quirky. And it goes back, in fact, Thomas Paine actually helped write the Rights of Man there. He lived there.
Oh, my.
He was the gatekeeper to the town.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So it's got lots of history.
I guess.
Yeah. So I tweeted, well, what's happened to this? And they said, one of the young guys actually came back and said, in-laws have just bought it or whatever, and we're going to do it. And I went in there one day and they said, what do you think? And I said, well, do you really want to know? And I helped them for about 18 months. And we doubled the turnover. But what was really interesting was how they managed the social media kick pushback from people who were jealous. And that was a very good lesson, which it came out in one of the stories where I talk about the ability to handle that. Mm-hmm. There's always a grain of truth and you invite people in and say, yeah, we're very lucky, but why don't you come and have a coffee and talk about it? Mm-hmm. It's on us. And then your community, if you've built this properly, your community goes after them. and says, stop being a jerk. So these are the sort of things that you learn, aren't they, as you go through.
That is a practice of true community building, because I think the human framework is easy to say, as soon as something negative's pushed back, you're like, get away.
Yeah.
We got two choices. You don't know what you're talking about.
You ignore it, or you sound out.
But or you throw rocks back.
Yeah. But there's always a grain of truth, and you have to go with the field to punch.
The classic line that comes to mind in that response is, tell me in a different way what I'm not seeing. Help me to see what you're seeing. I don't see it.
One of the businesses, we have a virtual assistant in the Philippines, and we had an induction session this week. One of the first aspects that I said to her, because having worked in the Philippines for a period of time, everybody says, yes, Mr. Paul. and there is very little pushback, because people aren't like that. They're very humble. So you actually don't know whether it's landed or not.
Right, yeah.
And I've done this in other businesses where I've advised the board for the first 6 months, where you have English as a second language for many people, you have a phrase, I heard you to say and understood you to mean. And everybody will say that. And that gets over the embarrassment.
Yeah.
And it means that you've got this understanding, a deeper understanding of what you're trying to do. That was one of our first things we did this week. Say, okay, in an organization, especially in a knowledge management organization, you've got to use lots of different techniques to get people to participate, to genuinely buy the program, if you like.
Well, you kind of have to have the mentality, you need to keep it at a low simmer
and
not boil over and not go cold. The reason I say that is because as you were speaking, I was thinking of the quick action that social media has given us the tool for now. To what point, to what end does that serve?
I think the big challenge now is, because there is so much work being done as distributed working, that you've lost that instant facial reaction. And I use the phrase, you've got virtual presenteeism, if you think about it, in lots of organizations. Whereas people used to turn up and not necessarily, that age is, you look as though you're working. I don't think knowledge management dies with, I think it actually improves and increases with not just AI, but the big thing has always been curation, hasn't it? And the amount of misinformation now is greater than it's ever been. I've gone on long enough. I hope that was helpful.
Thank you for being here. Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Because You Need to Know, the Reference Podcast in Knowledge Management. My name is Sony Toneme. As an art administrator, Because You Need to Know has been my go-to podcast and has helped me hone my management skills. Please consider sponsoring the podcast with your business.
You have just finished our latest Because You Need to Know, a public service of Pioneer Knowledge Services. Please join us on LinkedIn and find us at pioneer-ks.org.